In this service, I'll be reading words from Martin Luther King, Jr. I'd just like to open with these. Every man and woman must decide whether they will walk in the light of creative altruism or the darkness of destructive selfishness. This is the true judgment. Life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? It is pretty difficult to like some people. Like is sentimental. And it is pretty difficult to like someone bombing your home. It is pretty difficult to like someone threatening your children. It is difficult to like congressmen who spend all of their time trying to defeat civil rights. But Jesus says, love them, and love is greater than like. When I speak of love, I am not speaking of some sentimental and weak response. I am speaking of that force which all of the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door that leads to ultimate reality. Something should remind us once that the great things in life are things we never see. You walk out at night and look up at the beautiful stars as they bedeck the heavens like the swinging lanterns of eternity and think you can see it all. Oh no, you cannot see the law of gravitation that holds them there. Today, January 10th, we honor the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He was born on January 15th, 1929, and if he were alive today, he would be celebrating his 81st birthday this coming Thursday. So he would be contemporary with some of you here, myself included. As a special way, we know that even though he has not been living, his way of life and his teachings are still an influence on the way we who are alive today can live our lives. As Unitarian Universalists, we say that the living tradition that we share draws from many sources. The second source that we draw from, words and deeds of prophetic women and men which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. Words and deeds of prophetic women and men who challenge us to use the transforming power of love. Now, some of us, when we hear words like prophet, prophetic, prophecy, we get a little jumpy. That's kind of a Unitarian Universalist response to words like that. Some of us are skeptics, either by birth or by training or by some form of reasonable reflection. We get jumpy with the understanding that assumes that these words are all about foretelling the future. A prophet, we may think, is someone who can foresee what is going to happen before it happens, and even why it's going to happen. Indeed, seeing the future is a small part of the Abrahamic prophetic tradition, but I want you to consider this larger meaning of prophetic. I want to suggest this morning that it is better understood to think of prophetic as not foretelling, but forthtelling. That is, prophetic is not so much about predicting what will happen in the future, but rather instead, I'm asking us to consider the meaning of prophetic as being called forth to live out and act in ways that can confront those structures, those systems, and unfair practices that diminish us as humans within the present, the right now, this time in our lives. Martin Luther King's words give us a lens not only for viewing ourselves, but for understanding the meaning of what he called prophetic love. For living our lives with prophetic love is a deeply meaningful way to live. And I hope I can touch on the many ways in which prophetic love can affect us in our lives. Now, for some of us, a very, very small number, it may mean not only living in the most meaningful way we can, but also suffering, and for some, dying in a most meaningful way. Dr. King spoke to the Unitarian Universalist Association when he gave in 1966 the Ware Lecture. This is a yearly lecture that is given by an outstanding thinker, speaker, to the General Assembly that is held every year. Dr. King, in part, said, "We cannot in all good conscience obey unjust laws because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. Throw us in jail and we will still love you. Threaten our children, bomb our homes, send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hours and drag us out on some wayward road and beat us and leave us half dead. And as difficult as it is, we will still love you. Send your propaganda agents around the nation and make it appear we are not fit morally, culturally, or otherwise for integration, and we will still love you. But be assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. And one day, we will win our freedom. We will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your heart and your conscience that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory." Now, I have used the term the words of Dr. King. And just as I have been speaking and you have been listening, I want us now to shift to another way of communicating. I have a video, a clip that I'm going to show. It's about the deeds of prophetic women and men. The time is March 1965, the place, Selma, Alabama. Perhaps you already know the story. Indeed, all Unitarian Universalists, children and adults, should learn about it, for it helps to remind us of who we are as a religious people and what we are called to be. A young African American named Jimmy Lee Jackson has been murdered near Selma while he was taking part in the voting rights demonstrations. In response, Dr. King called for a nonviolent protest in Selma, asking the all-white police and public officials to protect the citizens and allow African American citizens to register to vote. When they reacted with brutality, King called the clergy of America to join him in Selma. At 25 Beacon Street in Boston, the UUA Director of Social Justice, Reverend Homer Jack, and the UUA president at that time, the Reverend Dana McLean Greeley, helped spread the word to UUs and others. Among the first ministers to arrive in Selma were three Unitarian Universalists, James Reeb, Clark Olson, and Orloff Miller. On their first night in Selma, they were assaulted by a group of white racists. Reeb was brutally beaten and died a few days after he was attacked. And of the clergy who eventually came to Selma, Unitarian Universalist ministers were there in a vastly greater number than one would have predicted from the size of our denomination. Lay people also came. Viola Liuzzo, a UU from Detroit, drove her car down from Detroit to Selma to help drive civil rights workers around the county. As she was driving one young man back from Birmingham to Montgomery to back to Selma, Klansmen drove up alongside and shot her to death.
There was little chance that Southern blacks could exercise their right to vote if white didn't want them to. There were too many restrictions. Such as poll taxes and difficult civics tests inflicted upon blacks who tried to register.
The right to vote is so fundamental in democracy. So Selma was a campaign about something very fundamental that occurred at a time when the movement had a very high profile.
Jimmy Lee Jackson was a young black activist from Alabama who got involved with the movement to attain voting rights. But his life would be cut short on February 18th at a demonstration in Marion, Alabama. Jimmy saw his grandfather being beaten, and he pushed his way into the fray to protect him.
Shot in Estelle by state trooper, an Alabama state trooper.
Jimmy was taken to the hospital in Selma, 35 miles away, because the hospital in Marion, where he worked as an orderly, refused to treat him.
I know that there could have been something done for him, and it would have made me feel a lot better if they had tried to do something for his wound before bringing him to Selma.
He died 8 days later. The identity of the trooper who shot him was kept secret. No charges were ever filed. At one of two services for Jackson, Martin Luther King told the gathered crowd of 2,000 that Jackson's death must not be in vain.
The innocent blood of this fine servant of God may well serve as the redemptive force that will bring new life to this dark state.
Civil rights leaders used Jackson's death as a rallying cry.
And out of that came the decision we need to march to Montgomery and bring our cause, walk 50 miles if necessary, to bring the symbolic body of Jimmie Lee Jackson to the governor's mansion and insist upon the right to vote.
The road to Alabama's capital would begin with a journey out of Selma across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. It would not be an easy crossing. As plans for the march were set, Alabama Governor George Wallace, an ardent segregationist, issued an order that the marchers not be allowed to leave Selma. As these events unfolded, Reverend James Reeb, a 38-year-old white Unitarian minister in Washington, D.C., paid careful attention. A fervent supporter of the civil rights movement, he read and watched the news surrounding Jackson's death. He was deeply moved. On March 7th of 1965, Reverend Reeb watched news reports of the march. He was horrified by what he saw. The brutality that ensued came to be known as Bloody Sunday. John Lewis was there.
I can still hear the moans, the groans, and people crying out for help as they were being trampled by horses and the tear gas was spreading in my eyes.
I was
was sitting here by State Trooper Langston, and I felt like this was the last demonstration for me. To this day, I don't know how I made it back across the bridge, back to the space itself, back to the little church that we were in.
Governor Wallace's troopers had beaten the men and women who marched, but they hadn't beaten me.
It gave the whole sympathy of the nation to those people who bowed their heads and took the blows.
That really marked the civil rights movement coming of age.
The next day, Martin Luther King urged ministers throughout America to participate in the Selma campaign. Reverend James Reed was ready to take a stand. He packed his bags for Selma. On March 9th, Reverend Reed and 2,000 others prepared for a second attempt at marching from Selma to Montgomery. But in light of the previous violence, federal judge Frank Johnson ordered the march postponed. King did not want to disobey the federal order and complied, partially. The marchers crossed the bridge where they were again met by troopers. They then kneeled and prayers said. The marchers turned back and dispersed. That evening, after meeting with Dr. King, the marchers left Brown Chapel and dispersed to dinner. Clark Olson was a minister at the time. He'd come to Selma and had dinner with Reverend Reed and another minister, Orloff Miller, that had no idea this would be Reed's last summer.
Three of us decided to go to dinner in the Walker Cafe. It was a restaurant that catered to blacks, and that day was especially open to civil rights marchers.
Leaving the restaurant, we went turned to the right because it was a shorter distance back to the church. So we walked down here, this short distance toward the end of the block, and it was just about here that we noticed that three white men were coming at us from across the street, and they were shouting at us. They in fact shouted, "Hey, you niggers." All three of us were white, but they used that epithet. And they came up behind us. I was standing nearest the wall here, and Jim Reed was nearest the curb, and they came up behind us, and one of them carried this club and swung it and hit Jim on the side of the head here, just above his ear. And we fell to the, Jim fell to the ground.
Reed suffered a massive skull fracture and a blood clot.
I remember vividly his holding my hand and squeezing it tighter and tighter from the pain, apparently. He was not able to speak, but he was holding my hand, and then he went unconscious.
Reed's friends took him to the hospital. 2 days later, he died. 3 days after that, on March 15th, 1965, President Johnson addressed the joint session of Congress and presented his proposal for a Voting Rights Act. He memorialized Reverend Reed and stunned much of America when he infused his speech with the sacred rallying cry of the Civil Rights Movement.
Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
I was sitting next to Dr. King. When Lyndon Johnson said, "We shall overcome," and tears came down his face, he cried. I said, "We'll make it ourselves, okay?" And the Voting Rights Act will be passed.
As for justice, there was none. Three men were picked up and charged with Reed's murder. But the outcome was a familiar refrain. An all-white jury found them not guilty. Nonetheless, like deaths of the martyrs before him, Reed's murder was not guilty.
I think it affected people in the South. I think Christian people looked at a minister being beat to death and thought, this may not be Christian what people are doing against these black people. I think it started planting some seeds of fairness.
The Selma campaign was far from over, and people were still joining. A Detroit housewife was about to leave the safety and comfort of her home and risk everything for her beliefs. only white woman to be murdered in the Civil Rights Movement. She would also be the only martyr to die twice. Viola Liuzzo was a different kind of martyr. She was the only white woman to be murdered while participating in the Civil Rights Movement. And she was the only person to be killed twice. After her life was snuffed out, her reputation was destroyed. To this day, her memorial, though made of granite, is fragile. And even iron bars struggle to protect her memory.
Even as young children, we knew that our mom was different from the other moms that we knew. She was spontaneous, she was playful. She was not regimented into the housewife routine.
Viola Liuzzo was different from many of the mothers in Detroit. For one thing, she was a daughter of the South, growing up in Georgia and Tennessee.
She grew up in the Jim Crow South. She saw discrimination firsthand, and she knew that she was as poor or poorer than many of the people who discriminated against, but she did not feel that same sting.
Even when she moved to Detroit, Viola never stopped caring about people who were less fortunate. But she got married and became a mother of five, and that became her passion.
She was magical. Our holidays were magical. Our birthdays were magical. She'd take us kids out in the summer during the day, and we'd all get home just in time to kind of straighten up the house before my dad got home, because Mom said the house will be here a long time after I go home. We can do better than
that. Viola admired people who committed themselves to the Civil Rights Movement. When the Selma campaign began, she followed her carefully. On March 7th, 1965, she found herself watching the same televised footage that had stirred Reverend James Reed. When Reed was killed, Viola Liuzzo cried, and then began to pack for a journey to Selma, Alabama. Her husband Jim was concerned, but did not try to stop her. Viola drove her Oldsmobile some 800 miles from Detroit to Selma to participate in history. After two failed attempts by Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Marches to walk from Selma to Montgomery, they were finally successful. Thanks in large part to the protection they received from President Johnson, who sent in federal troops. On March 25th in Montgomery, after a three-day march, the demonstrators gathered at the Capitol. Despite the suffering and more of the journey, they were jubilant.
We're on the move now. The beating and killing of our brethren and young people will not divert us. We're on the move now.
At the conclusion of the march, Viola Liuzzo shuttled a weary protester back to Selma. She was accompanied by a young black man named Leroy Moore. But there were Klansmen in Selma. They had been sent to keep the marchers under surveillance and were enraged the march had been successful. As Liuzzo and Moten headed back to Montgomery, a carload of Klansmen spotted the pair and stopped.
They were a perfect symbol of everything the South hated the most at that point in time. An outside agitator mixing with black people.
The Klansmen followed Liuzzo's car along Highway 8 for 20 miles. Then on this very same stretch of road, pulled alongside and fired shots. As the car went out of control, it crashed into the bank. Leroy, who played dead when the Klansmen stopped to check their work, was injured but survived. Viola had been shot in the head and died instantly. Within hours, the Liuzzo family learned the awful truth.
I don't know how to tell you what that feels like to hear something like that, and you don't ever, I know that people think that it's been a long time, but you don't ever really forget that shock. It kind of never goes away.
Just days after her murder, in an unusual move, President Johnson himself announced a break in the hunt for killers.
Arrests were made a few minutes ago of four Ku Klux Klan members in Birmingham, Alabama, charging them with conspiracy to violate the civil rights of the murdered woman.
The reason the Klansmen had been identified so quickly was because one of the four men in the car was an FBI informant, Gary Rowe.
Hoover and the Birmingham FBI were criticized because the question was asked, why would an FBI informant who was in the car not try to stop the murder? And so Hoover was very upset about that criticism.
The FBI's use of paid Klan informants created a public relations quandary for Hoover and the Bureau. The FBI had been relying on these informants to infiltrate the Klan ever since the murders of the three civil rights workers the summer of 64. But there was really no way to control the activities of the informants. Hoover was worried the FBI would appear responsible for the tragedy. For on the very day of the Liuzzo murder, Klan informant Gary Rowe had telephoned a warning to his FBI contact. Rowe reported that violence was planned. After the killings, Hoover sought to bury this fact. He launched a public relations smokescreen. Viola Liuzzo would be falsely portrayed as a bad mother, a drug addict, and a mistress.
This is the case where there's a systematic, deliberate effort, almost a conspiracy, to destroy this person, not just physical, but to destroy her family, her memory.
Hoover not only had his staff leak his speculations about Viola Liuzzo to the press, but to the Klan as well. But President Johnson, who was frequently at odds with Hoover over the civil rights movement, was enraged at the death of Viola Liuzzo. As a direct result, he ordered Congress to begin a thorough investigation of the Klan. Johnson declared war.
I have fought them all my life because I believe them to threaten the peace of every community where they exist. I shall continue to fight them because I know their loyalty is not to the United States of America, but instead to a living society of bigots.
When three Klansmen were indicted for the murder, the state had a strong case. After all, the fourth man in the car was a paid informant and was an eyewitness to the killing. Leroy Moten would also testify about what he witnessed. But the Klansman's attorney delivered a scathing renunciation of the murder. A white woman who was in a car with a black man. The defense also attacked the credibility of the FBI's Klan informant, Gary Rowe.
The defense said that he was a man who put his hand on the Bible and swore the Klan oath of secrecy and broke that oath, and therefore he could not be trusted no matter what he said. And the jury took that very seriously.
The case ended in a hung jury, and during the retrial, court watchers, journalists, and America heard the all too familiar refrain, an all-white jury delivered a verdict of not guilty. But finally, the U.S. Justice Department brought federal indictments against the three men. They were charged with conspiracy to violate Viola Liuzzo's civil rights, and in December of 1965, a federal grand jury found them guilty. They were sentenced to the maximum 10 years in prison. The death of Viola Liuzzo, as well as those of Reverend James Reed and Jimmie Lee Jackson, were not in vain. In addition to the court victory in the Liuzzo case, there was a major civil rights triumph. In response to the deaths and the publicity generated by the Selma to Montgomery March, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act on July 9, 1965. The bill outlawed obstacles to black voting and authorized federal officials to enforce fair voting practices. All over the South, thousands of blacks were registered to vote during the following year. Even with the right to vote protected by law, the act of voting remained dangerous as civil rights activists helped blacks register, a Klan leader would contrive a death.
They say that pictures are worth thousands of words, and I believe the footage that we just witnessed tell the tragic story of the three individuals, Jimmie Lee Jackson and James Reeb and Viola Liuzzo, much more compellingly than words that I could use. There has been recent work investigating the wrongful judgments, especially in the case for Viola Liuzzo. The Unitarian Universalist Association, 10 years ago, did create a bronze memorial that is now in the Elliott Chapel in our main office building in Boston on 25 Beacon Street. And I know that our young people are going to be traveling to Boston in March, and they will be able to see that bronze memorial to Jackson, Reeb, and Liuzzo. I just wanted to close with these thoughts. Prophetic loving is about listening to hearts, ours and others. What does it mean to draw from the lives of prophetic women and men who confront these structures and systems of unfairness and injustice, or who are unwilling to give up? I submit to you that it means that we draw from the great prophets, of course, but it also means that we need to draw from the lives of ordinary folk, just like you and I here sitting this morning. What if we took to heart the prescription that to open our hearts by observing what in our daily lives surprises us, what moves us, what inspires us? We could begin right here with those of us sitting beside us. For we, all of us here, have the potential and the promise to be prophets. We too can live lives from which others can draw inspiration and strength. We too are part of a living tradition, our living tradition. So I close with this thought that we open our hearts and our minds to the words and deeds of great prophetic women and men, and also to the lives of ordinary men and women. And may we be surprised and touched and inspired as we discover that all of us can answer the call to prophetic loving and living. And now, as we take our leave, before we gather here again, let us take heed of Hermann Hagedorn's words. We must do a harder thing than dying is. We must think, and ghosts will drive us on. And may we remain together in spirit till the hour we meet again. Go in peace, return in love.